because you can torture data to say whatever you want. I've seen that in many of the organizations I've worked at.
AI doesn't fix bad foundations. It just builds houses of cards faster.
It's like the easiest indicator for me to understand, like, oh, are you actually data informed, or are you just driving based off your gut and intuition? And to be clear, I actually think gut and intuition is a form of data, right? Like, the more experience you have, the better.
Absolutely.
Fine-tuning your gut and intuition. And so when I think about more senior people, they tend to have, if they have more experience, they tend to rely on their gut and intuition more, because I've seen a lot of the qualitative, quantitative data over their career to actually inform their future belief system. Okay, well, tell me about a time where you recently used data to make a decision. And they literally can't remember an example of that. In Amplitude's Salesforce CRM, there was 6 Patrick Thompsons. There was an Atlassian Patrick Thompson and Amplitude to clarify an iteratively personal email, and then my venture fund email as well. You know, only about a year or two away from more of an outcome-based model where, like, we should actually be helping drive revenue for your business and actually showing the value that we're able to actually have there.
Welcome to Knowledge Distillation, where we explore the rise of the AI analyst. I'm your host, Katrin Ryben, CEO and founder of Ask Why. This is episode 5, and today we're talking with Patrick Thompson, CEO and co-founder of Clarify, about why data quality is the unglamorous foundation that makes everything else possible, and why AI doesn't fix bad foundations, it just builds houses of cards faster. Patrick, I usually do the intro, but let's break that pattern. Please tell us about your journey as a founder, your experience at Amplitude, and what made you want to build again.
I'm excited to be here, and great to chat with you about all the things here related to data. For folks that don't know me, my name is Patrick. I'm based in Seattle. I'm the co-founder CEO of a company called Clarify, but previously was the co-founder CEO of a company called Iteratively that Amplitude acquired back in 2021, which was a customer data platform solving a lot of the data quality challenges that teams faced. Before that, I worked on growth at Atlassian.
Great. So let's distill some knowledge. Patrick, when you co-founded Iteratively, you saw the same pattern at hundreds of companies. We all know the pattern. It's a pattern where, analysts spending a lot of time questioning their data, more time actually questioning the data than analyzing it. Teams build dashboards, launch experiments, make decisions, and then you discover that the tracking was wrong, the data quality doesn't support what you want to do. We've all been there. Tens, if not hundreds of times. And obviously, nobody ever knows that the data is wrong until it's too late, because nobody really had a chance to look at it in that way until then. And then you've done all of this work and you realize, oh, some basic stuff isn't working. So can you tell us, what principles did you build Iteratively with? Like, what were we solving for? What was your key differentiation, your key insight there?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Actually, working on growth at Atlassian, we ended up using data a lot for experimentation, for personalization, and ended up having to build a lot of the tooling in-house. So when deciding to actually leave Atlassian to go start a company, you're right, I interviewed hundreds of people doing customer discovery, trying to figure out what problems they had, and then realized that nobody really had the tooling that we had ended up building in-house at Atlassian. So I ended up building a solution similar to what we had called Data Portal, which allowed folks to do accurate event instrumentation. And effectively, it was kind of a mini data dictionary, an event pipeline that did quality monitoring. And what we saw from all the interviews that we did is that typically, analytics is very much a team sport. It requires collaboration across engineering and product and growth and other stakeholders that use the data. And so what we wanted to do is, how do we build a system more akin to GitHub, where folks can collaborate around their data, really provide the definition of what's needed, be able to define the metrics that matter to the organization, instrument them reliably, and then be able to analyze it long-term as well. This was a fairly quick journey for us. We ended up raising about $5.5 million in venture and then got acquired within about 2 years from Amplitude. We're working with a bunch of different companies like Box.com, Canal Plus, Freshly, Thrive Market, you name it, who really wanted to be able to understand their customers. And the biggest gap was just the amount of time it took to instrument and this back and forth loop across the data producer and the data consumer. And this, I still say is probably not a solved challenge today, as you allude to. There's many organizations I still face this problem. And it's funny because it's still equally as relevant, even in the context of CRM, we're focusing on at Clarify today when it comes to kind of garbage in, garbage out problems. The principles that we really focus on is, how do we think about data as a team sport and involve the right stakeholders? How do we build such an easy to use product that anybody can do it? It didn't require kind of a PhD. And then I'd say third is that understanding that data in general is iterative, right? So it's not like you're going to get it right the first time. The reason we called the company Iteratively is that very much you probably define what was important. You try to instrument it. You would get some analysis and you find that you're missing something. There's some key piece of customer data or information that you wanted to capture, and you have to go re-instrument, regather the data. And, you know, I think this is where companies like Keep try to do implicit tracking. And then there's companies like Amplitude that try to do explicit tracking. We're a little bit more, I'd say, in the form, the explicit tracking camp, for what it's worth, because we just found that the data quality was higher there. But now with AI, it feels like there's a lot of signal you can get generally from the noise of implicit.
And so just for the audience, could you explain explicit tracking versus implicit tracking?
Yeah, 100%. So explicit tracking would be an engineer actually instrumenting an event. So there's a dot track event where somebody's writing code in their code base to actually capture a particular event. Implicit is you instrument or you add an SDK to your product that then tries to capture a bunch of different signals, right? I think this is more where RUM and other performance monitoring tools have really kind of worked well in the past. And then people really tried to apply that to more behavioral analytics. And I'd say up until recently, it's been really hard to sift through the noise, because what you're doing with implicit tracking is you're basically making the haystack bigger, but the needle kind of stays the same. Whereas previously you want to do explicit tracking, where you think about analytics as code and it's testable and it's deterministic. I'd still say there's value in both here for what it's worth. And, you know, even a company like Amplitude has since added implicit tracking, what we would call auto capture, to their product. Now with CRM, it's something that's very similar for us, right? CRM is kind of a garbage in, garbage out problem, whereas people typically require a lot of manual effort to capture data. And now we're working on tools to make that auto capture of information in CRM just much easier for teams.
So you've, and you know, about the implicit tracking, just something that you're saying that it makes the haystack bigger. I would argue sometimes it actually makes the haystack just being a stack of needles. And you're trying to find a needle in the stack of needles, yeah. Which... that really creates, it can really create a lot of noise when it's badly applied. But no, it absolutely has its use cases. So you're saying, you know, this is a team sport, right? So you, and I could not agree more. So Iteratively was working across data engineers, data analysts, stakeholders, and so your product was working across all of those. I suppose that you worked with a lot of companies, and what would you say within that process, having been able to sort of work with so many people as a team, what are the signs that tell you this company has a data trust problem? This company has some things in place that make it possible for them to actually build data trust relatively fast, if, you know, iteratively, but at a certain pace?
Yeah, I think the challenge with most organizations is most organizations have a data trust problem. It's not always the data, right? And so when you think about being data-driven or data-informed, however you want to talk about it, there are folks in organizations that have an implicit bias to that their belief system is the right one, right? And they're looking for data to either confirm it, but they're not looking at data to prove it, right? And that's or disprove it, I'll say, right? And so when I think about organizations that understand data, they're not looking to prove out their hypotheses, they're looking to disprove them. And because you can torture data to say whatever you want, I've seen that in many of the organizations I've worked at and many of the companies that I've worked with. And so quite often when it comes to being data informed or being able to use data, you can put the same data set in front of two different individuals within the same organization and get two wildly different outcomes of the analysis. And so this is the hard part, where it's not always just a instrumentation problem. There's the data literacy challenge of how easy is it for people to analyze the data. And like, you know, there's organizations that invest quite heavily in upskilling people on how to write SQL and buying better BI tooling. There's organizations that embed analysts into each of the different product teams, because it's kind of the fourth leg in the stool, a bit similar to design, product, and engineering. And then there's organizations that centralize analysis because they want to, I wouldn't say gatekeep, but they want to ensure that the quality of analysis is at a high level. And so you see this like distributed or federated model or centralized model quite often with organizations for analytics teams. And I tend to like a federated model where you're trying to teach folks how to use data, but it is hard when people are naturally fighting their own biases, because they don't want to be proven that they're wrong, right? Like people like feeling like they're right more often than not. But something else that you were mentioning earlier is probably worth chatting about just quickly, which is like, what are the systems of reward that these organizations have as well, right? Because depending on the upper echelon of management or leadership within the organization and how they think about data and how they think about making decisions, that will definitely influence people below them, right? And influence the behaviors that are being driven. So there's a lot of companies, I think, that will play lip service to be like, yeah, we're a data-informed organization. And the first question that I typically would ask them is, okay, well, tell me about a time where you recently used data to make a decision. And they literally can't remember an example of that. And it's like the easiest indicator for me to understand, like, oh, are you actually data informed, or are you just driving based off your gut and intuition? And to be clear, I actually think gut and intuition is a form of data, right? Like the more experience you have, the better
Absolutely.
You're fine-tuning your gut and intuition. And so when I think about more senior people, they tend to have, if they have more experience, they tend to rely on their gut and intuition more, because they've seen a lot of the qualitative and quantitative data over their career to actually inform their future belief system. So not to say that that's not a good form of decision-making. I think it really is, especially with absence of data. But if people don't have that experience and they're not relying on the qualitative or quantitative data that's available to them, then it's like they're just shooting in the dark.
Yeah, I think that data, ultimately decision-making, which is the goal, right? The goal of data analysis is to support somebody who makes a decision.
Yeah.
So that decision-making and the whole process that leads to it, it's very much a human process. AI or not AI, ultimately, it is very much a human process, and a human process that involves trust. Trust in the data, trust in the analyst, trust in the entire process. And if that trust doesn't exist, the data will not be used to make the decision. And data quality is an absolutely essential part of obviously building that trust. It's not the only part, but it is an absolutely essential part of building that trust. And if you don't have that, everything else ultimately is a house of cards, right? In one of your blog posts, I think this was a blog post that you wrote when you were at Amplitude. It was titled Prioritize Outcomes Over Outputs. I mean, that's basically struck me as being context engineering before Jeff Huber coined the term, really. So how do you think about that relationship between data quality, context, and ultimately trust?
Yeah, I think the outcomes over outputs thing is an interesting one. And I think a lot of organizations end up operating as kind of feature factories where they just ship feature after feature after feature, right? And specifically talking about product organizations here. But they're not necessarily measuring, like, are these things actually laddering up? In absence of data, velocity is a very good indicator, right? So like, not say like shipping is a good input measure.
But that can be true for an analytics team as well. Tickets closed, you know, like you can translate that to a lot of contexts.
Yeah. But there's always the five whys, right? Like, you know, let's assume you generate an insight. Let's assume you have an embedded or an embedded analytics model, right? Where you have an analyst who's working on generating insights, right? And there's hopefully some business unit that's requested information or requested some analysis, and the analyst goes and actually performs some analysis. They generate an insight. Well, how is that insight used, right? And what decisions were made by that business unit that hopefully impacted, and what was the impact of the business by those decisions, right? So this is the downstream impact of analysis, which is, can you actually measure the outcome of the work that you're doing as an organization. There's a lot of people that have talked about this as well, but it's the goal of analysis is hopefully better decision-making over time. And this is why I do think it's still even in the context of building a muscle, right? Like you have to train it, right? People are going to be fairly bad once they start going to the gym, right? But then, you know, the first 3 or 4 weeks of going to the gym suck. No one likes it. Like it hurts. But like over time, you're like, okay, cool. You develop the muscle memory. You get better at working out. It becomes more of a habit than more of a one-off. And so when you develop that habit of good analysis and actually understanding how to use the data, and then also harrowing internally, like, you know, being able to stand up at an all hands and be like, hey, this is some analysis that we did, and this is the outcome of that analysis. Like you're showing that you care as an organization and you're developing that muscle. And this is what's really hard, is I don't think people do a good job of that within many businesses today.
And how are you thinking about that problem, the context quality foundation problem, at Clarify in a completely different domain, really?
I mean, yeah, we're an early stage startup, so we're only about 25 people today. And so we talk about metrics every all hands, right? And then we try to go into them, we try to analyze them, but like we're still operating quite heavily on qualitative data and gut and intuition over quantitative data. And we have the quantitative data and we've done the instrumentation, we do the analysis there, but we have fairly clear signals and indicators on what we need to go do as a business to, I'd say, like hit the benchmarks that we're trying to go after.
And within your product, how does that translate into thinking of, like, you know, maintaining this context and this data quality in your product, which I'm sure you're obviously dog fooding and using your product as well, right?
We're the number one customer at Clarify is Clarify, right? We dog food everything and use it every single day, hours a day, to power our go-to-market motion. I think the thing that I think about for data quality in the context of CRM, for what it's worth, and like think about quality and data quality, and it's funny when we did this discovery back in 2019, you know, quality came up in regards to data that's in your warehouse. It came up in regards to data that's in your CRM. It came up in regards to the experimentation or marketing campaigns that you're running on top of the data as well. So quality comes up across the entire spectrum, but a lot of the focus that we have both at the last startup and this startup is around customer data. And so customer data being, you know, CRM being a core aspect of customer data. And so for us, when we think about that, the standard CRM challenge around data quality is like identity resolution, right? Yes. So you have multiple of the same people, right? Like in Amplitude's Salesforce CRM, there was 6 Patrick Thompsons. There was an Atlassian Patrick Thompson and Amplitude to Clarify and iteratively personal email, and then my venture fund email as well. So
I mean,
you
have
all
clients who have had like 17 instances of Salesforce.
Yeah. And so when I think about AI and what we're trying to do is like, we're trying to build a better entity resolution model for like how to, well, one, normalize the data, and then two, be able to stitch the data together. Right. And like we did some actually cool stuff at Amplitude around building kind of a identity graph across these and being able to alias identities together. And we're trying to apply some of that same learning and insight into the context of CRM. That's a standard data challenge that you have, which is like, what person do I reach out to if I'm running any analysis on top of this? Like, how do I stitch together the timeline of customer communication across multiple different entities? And that's just one example of like how we think about building a better product that can solve some of the data challenges. Additionally, just like managing fields and field usage, we at Amplitude built what we called kind of the data portal, which inside of Amplitude data portal, we had things like a health score, like how healthy is your data? And then you can actually see the entire data dictionary of all the different events that you were, that you had as well and how they were used downstream. So what was the analysis? Like what analysis was built on top of these events inside of Amplitude? And so we're thinking about ways to kind of incorporate that same level of thinking into, cool, we have all these fields on these core objects and you have custom objects and you have fields, but like, how are these being used and queried and analyzed? And are there any downstream campaigns that are being built on top of this data? And being able to show utilization is a great way of at least understanding like, where should I be going spending my time if I'm an analyst actually validating data as well? And then using things like anomaly detection as just I'll call it more machine learning than AI. I think that term is pretty overloaded these days. to understand like, hey, are there things that we should be looking for, signals that we should be looking for to alert people? I think the hardest part about data quality is you don't want it to be a passive thing. You want it to be kind of an active thing where like the systems that you're using should actually help inform you if there's an error or a challenge. Whereas this is actually the same for most analytics tools today. For what they're worth, you're having to pull information out of them instead of them pushing information to you. We're really trying to think about building a system that's pushing you information and insights instead of just being an analytics platform or a data platform.
It makes sense, right? Because one of the main challenges a lot of data teams have in certainly in larger organizations is ultimately that kind of like send dashboards across the ocean, sometimes literally. And they don't really know what is being used, what is it being looked at in all of their tables, data models, et cetera. It's very hard to know whether something is being utilized because it's not because you are sending a dashboard that's being opened and that anything is being done with it. Correct. So that's really something that signal is really hard to get. I feel like we have a chance with generative AI and potentially some sort of like evolved self-serve BI where once you have a really clean data model and you have like, you know, good data quality, et cetera, you can have some level of self-served conversational, you know, interrogating of the data by the people who need to make decisions. That gives you a lot of signal.
Yeah, we recently launched our MCP connector to Clarify, and we're about to launch Rep, which is our agent built into Clarify as well, which has like tool calling and a bunch of other things, but it's really, really good at the analysis side of the data. The hard part is then reconnecting the loop into like, okay, how is this analysis actually changing how we think and operate as a company? And because, you know, it's pretty much disconnected from the other tools and systems that we use, which we're hoping to plug the gap on, which is like tools like Linear for software engineering or the SDLC, and then Notion for a lot of our documentation. But the goal being that like once you actually have an agent that can help do the analysis, is can it actually learn from that analysis of is it changing behavior internally? And like we're a little bit far away even ourselves from being able to close the loop there, but it does definitely unlock a way of operating that I think will be super beneficial for teams in the future.
So one of the ways that we kind of like look at AI analysts is by looking at AI engineers, because mm-hmm. we can sort of look at our engineering cousins and see what's, you know, part of what's probably going to happen to our roles. So how is your engineering product organization different at Clarify than it was at Amplitude or at Iteratively?
There's a few things that we do differently this time around. We hire a lot more product engineers, like people that can actually think like a PM or designer who can understand the customer problem and then figure out what the potential solutions look like, and then actually be able to have good product sense and being able to like, or, you know, build it. And that's something that, you know, I'd say has been a trend over the last like 5 or 6 years within the industry. And so we hire a lot more folks that, you know, have been PMs that are also come from an engineering background and want to actually focus on this particular skill set. It means that, you know, generally they're wearing many, many hats throughout the day versus just one hat. So I would say it's not a good fit for everybody. I'd say the other thing is that we're trying to really build agency and autonomy within what we call pods. So we have a pod model internally at Clarify. So we're trying to organize these pods around particular missions and focus areas that we want to invest in, and then push the decision-making as far down to the team as we can. You know, I'd say this is working fairly well for us, honestly, because we're able to tackle multiple priorities at any point in time without necessarily being bottlenecked by resources or having to figure out how to best organize or self-organize the teams. I'd say that's something that's very different. The other thing is we ended up investing fairly heavily in Clarify's data architecture early on. So we're a multi-tenant, single-tenant architecture, which means that every customer has their own unique warehouse of data that's purely separated and isolated from every other customer. And then we actually built Clarify to be extensible, and you can connect it to any BI solution you want, right? So for us, like because we're warehouse native, like you actually have like the ability to go connect directly into Looker or Mode or Hex or whatever other tool you want. Hopefully, Ask Why as well. specifically to go run the analysis.
It makes a lot of sense. You don't want to reinvent that layer.
Yeah, exactly. And like the thing about reporting and what we've seen for pretty much every organization we talk to that's a Salesforce company is they end up exporting the data out of Salesforce into Snowflake or some other warehouse anyways, and then building reporting specifically when it comes to time series reporting, because Salesforce doesn't really shine there on the time series side. And because they don't do a full activity capture on all the field level updates as well, it's really hard to use it for modeling, I'd say, for forecasting, which is why like companies like Clary exist to begin with. And so for us, like we just kind of embraced it from the beginning, which is that, you know, we're definitely taking more of a modern data stack approach to how to build a company, and just embracing the fact that like companies are going to want to bring their own BI solution and reporting solution to Clarify.
And what you described with your product engineering and pod structure is very much what I hear a lot around analytics, changes in analytics teams and roles, where we see, because AI is really powering this full stack extension of analyst skill sets, you see people embracing a lot more of the analytics lifecycle and a lot more of this sort of like pod, you know, sort of probably so, something of what you were fostering at Iteratively, where you have people collaborating more across the board, as opposed to just like staying in strictly analysts a team. What do you see your users do differently, or how do you feel their expectations are changing as to how they sort of think about using systems today?
I mean, I think a lot about agents, and there's ambient AI, and then there's more like agent AI. So like in Clarify, we built a lot of ambient AI. So it just runs in the background and does work for you. But we have our agent as well that you can just query information from. And I see the normal default expectation that's primarily been driven by the user behavioral change from tools like ChatGPT and Claude is that people just expect to do a lot more like natural language queries on top of their data instead of having to go build reports via like a point and click editor. And you know, even the context of like this one-off analysis has, in my mind, like what we've seen both internally for our own organization as well as what we've seen within customers, especially when it comes to like MCP, our MCP connector, is that they just let the analysis rip. They just like ask question after question after question. They try to slice and dice the data in many, many different ways. This still all assumes that people know how to ask good questions, which is a different topic, or the right question.
Yes, it is.
But it basically has unlocked superpowers for a large group of people that potentially were hamstrung or resource constrained previously. Because what we found is like LLMs are really good at writing SQL still. And like if you provided a relatively constrained schema data model, like it can give you an answer. And you know, I still think it's worth fact checking and making sure that you're validating the data, or at least the analysis.
Yeah. This is really where your data quality needs to be. To be there, right? Like, because if you're opening that door and your data quality isn't there, I mean.
Yeah, I always think about like chaining or cascading events, right? So we use AI to automate a lot of the manual data entry, and then we use AI to analyze a lot of the data inside of Clarify, right? And so if the data that we're automating as far as manual entry into the system is bad, then the analysis is going to be bad, which means that we have to have fairly high confidence in our ability to, you know, I'd say like autofill the data in the CRM. And then we also have fairly good confidence that we're validating the data that's being autofilled for the analysis to be accurate.
And from that perspective, obviously, one of the main pain points of CRM is compliance, data entry compliance.
Yeah.
All those are like that aspect is every sales leader's nightmare, right?
Yeah.
And I'd imagine that you can see already across your client base that organizational changes are taking place as a result of using a tool like yours. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, the metrics that we hope to move for our customers that we're getting some good signals on are the ability for people to just spend more time working with customers, right? So because we have this autonomous CRM running in the background that just works for them, like they're able to take on higher quotas, they're able to work with more customers, they're able to accelerate a lot of the sales things because we just automate a lot of the manual work, right? Whether or not it's like email follow-up or scheduling or pipeline management, we just take off which just take off the burden of that from them. So they're able to just do more with less. Now, the things that are interesting that I hope to move to a world of is right now we're very much kind of a consumption-based business model, right? So the more our AI does work, the more you pay us. I actually think we're, you know, only about a year or two away from more of an outcome-based model where like we should actually be helping drive revenue for your business and actually showing the value that we're able to actually have there. I think we're probably one of the only few CRMs that are thinking about that.
So if you think about your experience, you've been working with analysts for 15 years.
Whole academic career. Yeah.
There is a point where we call it 20 plus years and and that's it. And we never ask about the plus.
There is definitely gray in my hair now.
And you know, so obviously you've seen a lot of hype cycles, tool evolutions and revolutions, roles rising, falling, you know, changes, etc. What, in your opinion, is different this time around? And more specifically, if you're like you were advising an analyst today about what to invest in terms of skills to stay relevant in the foreseeable future, which the future is not very foreseeable these days, but still. In the hypothetically foreseeable future, what would you say?
I mean, context matters so much, right? In the so as an analyst in a business, your context, your understanding of the business, your relationships that you have with the different stakeholders is so much more valuable, right? Because what we're seeing right now is like the floor for analysis is being lowered. Right? So the ability for data democratization to happen within an organization is much, much better, right? Like you have better tools, you have just better systems record that you can query and analyze. You have better, and that's means that there's more analysis happening, generally speaking. Now, the hard part is there's the same thing with vibe coding. There's the difference between vibe coded analysis and actually really, really good analysis, right? There's a difference between vibe code and good code that's written by an engineer. And so I think the folks that are able to still tell a really, really good story with the data, be able to be have managed relationships and have the understanding of the context to be able to incite change or organizational change are going to be much, much more valuable. So this is the same thing when I have conversations with people like, oh, what should my kids study in university now? Should they actually learn how to do software engineering? I'm like, yeah, they should still learn how to do software engineering. But I think an engineer who understands business or understands the context of why the work that they do matters is way more valuable than someone who doesn't, who's just taking tickets off a queue. It's the same for somebody in support. It's the same for somebody in sales. It's the same for somebody in a data team. So like understanding organizational context and what matters, and then being able to distill your analysis into things that are actionable recommendations for the business, that's still a very valuable skill.
Yeah, when you say soft, like I had those questions as well. Should my kids still study software engineering? And I don't understand how the answer could possibly be no. Be it simply because you do need to look at what, as an analyst, right? As a software engineer, certainly, but as an analyst as well, you do need to look at the output of the AI. What it generates for you, you have to understand that code. You have to read that code. You have to understand what logic is being applied. How do you do that if you don't know how to read code? Maybe you're not going to write that much code anymore. Sure, you're still going to analyze it, understand it, architect processes. And certainly as much as you you start having agents that are being able to do more and more of the work for you, well, you're going to have to architect and plan what those agents are doing for you, right? Yeah, I really don't see how the answer to should I still study software engineering could possibly be no. But I think, you know, I'm thinking of it in terms of you have this whole area around analytics is a human process. Obviously, business is a human process. So you do need to have all those skills around the context. What is the business doing? How am I contributing? Where, who does what? Who sort of works with which pieces? And how does that reality get modeled into the data? So how do I create that data model that is modeling that reality? Consciousness of that model is a reduction of reality. It is compressing information. I will always have to add information on the context on top of it, and I will always have to do the translation between that compressed information and the actual reality. And that's on me as an analyst to do that translation, because I know what was compressed in the data model. I know how much of the reality is not there. And I think that aspect is extremely undervalued in our profession. It's kind of like this translation of what is exactly missing in this data in order to be able to transform this analysis into an actionable recommendation.
Yeah,
what do you think about that aspect?
A memory challenge as well, right? So when you think about an agent, right, like you're giving it memory, like you're providing context, but there's also memory that's valuable, right? And like mm-hmm. you're an analyst that understands the business and you've done a bunch of, you know, where the skeletons are in the data, it's a lot easier for you to be able to like navigate.
And there
that.
Are always skeletons in the data.
Correct. Yeah. And so like also working with a stakeholder, right? The interpersonal skills matter way more now, because it's like, you know, kind of what they're looking for or not, and you're able to better massage the deliverable, whether or not it's a report, to this particular person. So like, I'd say memory is the thing that is still a challenge, right? If you just have like a BI tool with like, it's generating SQL, based off a natural language input, like memory is still a challenge. And, context is still a challenge. So I think that's an area that an analyst, you know, can still outperform some of these tools. And then the question is like, do those things get solved over time? I think the answer is yeah, those get improved over time. But similar to like every other function, right? Like we're not gonna like see the disappearance of analysis. I think
Definitely not.
Yeah. The people that can do more with less are gonna be way more valuable. And so, you know, this is the same thing for engineers at Clarify, right? Like we expect them to do product work and design work and analytics work, right? We're expecting people to be able to take on more disciplines than what they historically would have been able to do potentially, because they have better tools available to them, right? And then they can context switch better.
Yes. And on that note, one of the things you touched on is it's a question as to whether, you know, people can ask good questions. And for that, if you think about natural language as your interface to to a number of tools these days, asking questions and prompting basically is a real skill, right?
Sure.
And it's true that got a bit of a like micro hype cycle maybe a year ago, where being a prompt engineer was something that was sought after, and maybe that has disappeared a little bit. But I think that's because that has been diffused in everybody's skill set. Like you are, I think, today expected to know at least the basics of prompt engineering, and the people who are really good at it differentiate. What do you see that in your team? Do you see that in your clients?
Yeah, I definitely. I think the one thing that you actually mentioned that I'd love to touch on a little bit is like, it's one of the challenges we had recently is somebody on the team was presenting data at Clarify, and it was very easy for me to see the data and know that it was wrong because I just know the business fairly well. But then it wasn't easy for them to look at the data and know it was wrong. And that's like the gut intuition where you're like, heck, how good are you at gut checking some of the numbers and the analysis that you've done? And are you using these tools as a crutch? So using them as a tool or using them as a crutch? If you don't understand the business, then it's really hard to know that. But I kind of expect people at Clarify to know the business so well that when they look at something, they can gut check it and be like, hey, is this right? Or is this directionally right? Or is it directionally wrong? And then when you dig in, you're like, hey, this was an analysis issue. Like the data that you looked at wasn't correct. And that's something that, you know, yeah, is very good at trying to be people pleasers, right? And like you ask it a question, it might give you an answer. You're like, oh, here you go. And you're like, no, you have to double check it. And still say that's a challenge that we face today. The question that you asked earlier as well, which is like, I tend to think of the evolution here of what's going to happen over time. So like these tools are only going to get better and better, right? I don't think we're going to hit this like, plateau effect here. I think we're still, I don't know if we're going to be accelerating at the same pace, but I still think they're only going to get better and better from here. So trying to train people to think of these as tools in their arsenal, right? The battering on their tool belt is valuable. And so what we tend to try to look for in folks is like, how AI literate are they, or how adaptable are they to using new tools? How quickly do they adopt things? And that's something that we tend to try to screen for a little bit more when it comes to hiring. It's been amazing to see folks internally pick up tools, especially as they iterate or try to test the new models, because we are still in this kind of, my belief is that we're still in this like rapid pace of acceleration and innovation within large language models. And like even the things that you see improved in Gemini 3.0, right, is amazing, right? And it's like,
it's so much fun. It's really great.
Yeah. And so this is a great time to be a builder.
Yes.
Right. And like the thought process of being like, I don't know, for me, like the thought process of being like locked away in a bigger, stodgy company and not having access to these things and not being able to experiment, that's actually what terrifies me with a lot of the people today.
I agree. I think that this is really the time to build an experiment. Well, Patrick, this has been amazing. We're coming up on time. I could do this for another hour easily. But for people who want to talk to you, I know you're hiring at Clarify. How do people get in touch with you? Where can people find Clarify? We'll put all of that in the show notes, but you know, so you can just tell people.
Feel free to reach out to me via email at patrick@clarify.ai or find me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to help anybody, and I really appreciate being on the pod.
Thank you so much, Patrick. We'll make sure all this is in the show notes. That's it for episode 5 of Knowledge Distillation. If today's conversation made you want to experiment with AI for analytics, visit us at askwhy.ai and try Prism. Thanks for listening. And remember, bots won't win, analysts will, but only if they're working with data they can trust. Thank you.
It was a great wrap.
Thanks to Tom Fuller for the editing magic on this episode. If you want to work with Tom, head to askwhy.ai and check out the show notes for his contact info.